Du lytter til Radio Krishna på 87,6 MHz, en dybere dimension i radio. I den næste halvanden time her i Radio Krishna skal vi høre en forelæsning med vores altid tilbagevendende videnskabsmand Sada Buddha fra San Diego, USA. Og her vil han i den første del af denne udsendelse tale om ud-af-kroppen-oplevelser og hvordan man kan diskutere det her fra et videnskabeligt synspunkt. I den anden del af denne udsendelse vil han fortsætte sin diskussion om evolution fra en tidligere udsendelse, og i den forbindelse vil han også vise en video. Jeg har valgt at tage lydsporet med, eftersom resten af diskussionen hviler lidt på denne videofremvisning. Det er en lidt længere sag det her, så jeg kan ikke sige så meget mere end værsgo til Sada Buddha, og fra teknik og produktion af denne udsendelse står Yadunandan Das.
Sabum out of body study that I mentioned yesterday, because perhaps some of the implications weren't completely clear. The main implication of that study that makes it interesting is that it indicates that the mind can function at a time when the brain, according to medical understanding, is not functioning. So the setting there was as follows. This represents time. Let us say a person has a heart attack beginning at this time. And at this point, he's successfully revived by the resuscitation methods that they use. So during this interval, the heart is not beating and there's no blood circulation. So according to medical understanding, when the blood is not circulating, the brain has no supply of oxygen or nutrients. And so very quickly, the brain ceases to function. So in particular, during that period, there would be no brain waves if you used an electroencephalograph to measure activity in the brain. So the brain waves would die out to nothing. Then later, once you revived the heart, they would build up again, assuming that there's been no brain damage, as is typically true in these cases where the person was successfully revived. So the idea is that during this interval, the brain is not functioning. There's no organized neural activity. So this would be comparable, if you want to make an analogy between the brain and a computer, this would be comparable to the situation in which you have a computer disconnected from its power supply. So the testimony that people reporting out-of-body experiences have given, for example, to this Dr. Sabum, was that they could observe the events involved in their own resuscitation. They would say that they found themselves hovering above their body from some vantage point, observing what the doctors were doing. And the whole point that Sabum made was that in a significant number of cases, they were able to give correct descriptions of the specific things the doctors were doing. And these were particular medical steps that are not necessarily carried out in the same way in every case. They vary. So the persons were able to give specific details, say, in this period of time when the brain was not functioning. So let's suppose for the sake of argument that these reports are as they seem. What are the implications? Well, it would seem that first of all, in this period in which the brain was not functioning, you had sense perception because they said they could see and hear. They were able to think. They had feelings. Typically, these patients reported that during this period, they felt a cessation of pain because, of course, since they were cardiac patients, usually they'd been experiencing a lot of pain. So this pain was notably absent during this phase of their existence. And then the third thing that was going on was that they were forming memories which they were able to recall later. And so you might ask, well, where was the memory being recorded? Because the brain is supposedly not functioning. So later on, when the body and the brain are functioning again, One might suppose that the memory gets recorded in the brain, possibly. But in this interval right here, the memory had to be existing in some form independent of the brain. So it would seem that you'd have to postulate some kind of system distinct from the brain that can record that memory. So that was the significant point in those studies. There's a further general lesson to learn from this, because many people may argue that we can deduce from different empirical studies that memory is stored in the brain. For example, it will be pointed out that if you damage certain parts of the brain, you can impair a person's memory. There's even the famous case of a man who's only referred to as H, who had bilateral removal of the hippocampus of the brain. And the result of this was that he was unable to form any memory that would last for more than 15 minutes from that point onward in his life. So he lived in a perpetual sort of window of 15 minutes. It's described that he lived in a room in his parents' house, reading the same Reader's Digests over and over again, and it was always fresh to him, because he had no memory that he'd read them time and time again. So this would certainly seem to indicate that the brain is necessary for memory. Yet here we have evidence suggesting that memories can be formed independently of the brain. So perhaps one solution to the problem is that when the mind is functioning, it uses the brain for storing memories, but it's capable of storing its own memories. Of course, according to Vedic literature, the subtle body, consisting of mind, intelligence, and false ego, carries all the karmic information concerning the conditioned soul and carries this in transmigration from one body to another. Of course, in this connection, you can mention another body of evidence, namely the reports of childhood memories of previous lives, reported, for example, by Ian Stevenson. Because there you have a large number of cases in which a young child who is just learning to speak will describe details of a previous life. And in a substantial percentage of these, it was possible to verify that that previous life history did in fact exist. That is, the person who was being described actually did live at an earlier time. Stevenson reports that at this point he has about 2,500 cases from around the world, and he has studied perhaps 30 or 40% of those. So it's a substantial amount of material. So I thought I'd just mention that. So today what... Yeah?
The man who couldn't remember beyond 15 minutes, how could he remember how to read?
Well, it's interesting. Skills were not impaired. So his ability to read wasn't affected. But
that's memory, though. Remembering what words... You couldn't remember the words, but you remember how to read them.
Yeah. It's curious. Brain damage seems to produce sort of what you might call specialized defects. Some forms of brain damage, for example, make it impossible for the person to speak, but he can still sing. So if he wants to talk to you, if he sings it, then he can do it. But if he tries to just talk in an ordinary way, he can't. There's some forms of brain damage that make it possible for the person to write, but he can't read. So if he writes something and tries to read his own writing, it's meaningless to him. But yet he knows what he's writing. So these various things take place. So today what I was going to talk about was the theory of evolution. Yesterday I was presenting some empirical evidence regarding theories of human evolution. But beyond that, there's the more general theory of how evolution is supposed to take place. And the theory of evolution occupies a rather central position philosophically and scientifically. Basically, the fundamental premise of modern science is that the absolute truth is very simple in nature. You might inquire into the motives for this fundamental assumption. Partly, it is the same philosophical motive that lies behind monism, or the philosophy that all is one. And partly, there are pragmatic reasons for wanting everything to be simple. Because if the ultimate absolute truth is very simple in nature, then there's some possibility that we will be able to understand it by scientific investigation. Whereas if it's extremely complex, then it becomes much more difficult to understand, perhaps impossible. So, for various motives, scientists have adopted the idea that the absolute truth ultimately is very simple. So, in the world, we see many complex forms that are highly organized, including in particular the bodies of living beings. So the question then arises, how did all these complex forms arise if the absolute is something very simple? It's basically a question of getting something out of nothing, or getting a lot out of very little, which amounts to the same proposition. So in Western science, the theory of evolution is postulated to account for this appearance of complex, variegated form, in particular the forms of living organisms, starting with a situation in which you don't have these complex forms. Of course, in modern cosmology, the idea is that you begin with what is called the Big Bang. So, after, of course, the Big Bang starts with a mathematical singularity, that is, mathematically undefinable conditions, so you can't say what the conditions are then. You can only say what the conditions are some fraction of a second after the Big Bang. So if you start a certain fraction of a second after the Big Bang, then according to modern cosmological ideas, reality consists of a plasma. An example of a plasma would be what you have inside a fluorescent light, glowing gas in a state of uniformity. So the idea is the whole universe was one uniform glowing mass of gas made up of subatomic particles. So there was no variety whatsoever. So this early state of the universe is in some ways comparable to the idea of the Brahman, which you find in certain forms of impersonal philosophy, because the Brahman is described as a uniform white light. Although more sophisticated philosophical accounts will say that even the idea of light is inapplicable because that involves the duality of light versus dark. Therefore, we can't even apply that idea. But in any event, at least on a somewhat naive level, you find modern science in the Mayavadi philosophy postulating a similar initial basis for the universe, which they take to be the total reality. So in the Mayavadi philosophy, there is also difficulty in accounting for variegated form. And the ultimate answer given in the Mayavadi philosophy is that the variegated form doesn't exist. And so one can try to comprehend that. Actually, it's quite incomprehensible. And the final proposal that is made is that it's all beyond words. So after speaking many words on the subject, one then says, it's beyond words. So that's the answer given in the Mayavadi philosophy to the problem of variegated form. So the corresponding answer given in Western science is that starting with this perfectly uniform, undifferentiated plasma, a physical evolutionary process took place. And as a result of this physical process, all the different forms that we know of came into being. So this leads ultimately to the idea that you had a primordial soup at some point on the surface of the Earth in which various chemicals were present in solution. There were different sources of energy, such as lightning and ultraviolet rays from the sun. Different chemical reactions took place in the primordial soup, and as a result of this, primitive living organisms came into being, and these began to reproduce. And through a process of natural selection and mutation, namely the Darwinian mechanism of evolution, these organisms gradually evolved and diversified until you have all the different species on the Earth today, including human beings. So that's the basic picture. So in presenting this theory of evolution, the scientists are engaged, I would propose, in a fundamentally fallacious mode of reasoning, which is very similar to the fallacious type of reasoning used in this whole area of artificial intelligence. And the fallacy is that you successfully explain one rather limited phenomenon, and then without really doing the work to give a detailed explanation that goes beyond that, you generalize this universally, and then you make propaganda to convince people that the general version is the actual truth. So, in particular, the Darwinian mechanism of evolution does work in certain limited circumstances. But in general, it hasn't been shown that that mechanism is capable of giving rise to all the different variegated life forms that you have on the Earth. The necessary work to show this hasn't been done. So when propaganda is made to induce people to accept this theory as the actual explanation of the origin of life, then this is not actually proper scientific presentation. It's essentially dishonest. So, nonetheless, at the present time, this theory is very widely propagated. And Srila Prabhupada asked the early members of the Bhaktivedanta Institute to refute this theory. Now, I should say a few words as to why that's important from the point of view of Krishna consciousness. Basically, for example, on two or three occasions in which I was with Srila Prabhupada, he actually expressed very deep feeling in this regard, because he pointed out that people are being misled by this false propaganda, and as a result, their access to spiritual understanding is closed off, because inasmuch as one adheres to this completely impersonal and atheistic way of understanding reality, he's unable to come to a proper spiritual understanding, to make spiritual advancement. So therefore, these theories have the effect of blocking people's spiritual progress. And since the real purpose of the human form of life is to make spiritual progress, that means that these theories essentially sabotage the human form of life. So Srila Prabhupada was quite concerned about that. And as he put it, he wanted us to show that life comes from life, not matter. So the point of that phrase is that life actually, with its complex form and so forth, originates from an antecedent form of life. And there is an ultimate primordial form of life, which is Krishna. So, essentially, the fundamental difference in philosophy between Krishna consciousness and the modern scientific viewpoint is that although both of them accept that there is a fundamental absolute truth underlying all of reality, in modern science, the idea is that that absolute truth is simple and impersonal in nature, whereas the fundamental premise of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is that the absolute truth is unlimitedly complex and is of the nature of conscious life, namely the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's the fundamental difference there. So in approaching this whole question of the theory of evolution, there are many different considerations that need to be made. One is to explain how, in fact, the different material bodies and so on originate according to the Vedic scheme, and to relate that to our scientific theories. So that was the partly what I was talking about the day before yesterday in explaining creation by sound vibration. The idea there is to give a plausible presentation of the basic Vedic description of the creation. And another aspect that's important in dealing with these theories is a somewhat negative one, namely to point out why the theory runs into difficulty. Because after all, if the scientific theory is in fact an adequate explanation of the phenomena of life, then one could say, well, why not accept that theory? In fact, it has great inadequacies. So I'm going to say a little bit about that today. And I have some more video material here, which is a little bit technical. It's essentially a presentation of a lecture that I gave at a conference on evolution in Budapest last year. Actually, I came through England on that occasion also. There was an international conference on evolution there, attended by many evolutionists from Europe and a few from America also. So I presented this particular material to them. This deals with looking at mathematical models of organisms or aspects of organisms. One fundamental feature of physical science is that it's based on the analysis of specific models. Essentially, what you do is you make a model of the phenomenon that you're interested in, and then you compare the behavior of the model with reality and see how well it fits. That's, for example, what Newton did with his model of the solar system and his gravitational laws and so forth. So in the theory of evolution, one approach is to make a sort of vague statement of what you think are the basic principles governing the evolutionary process and just say, well, this is how it must have happened. However, this does not allow further scientific exploration. You either accept the story or you don't accept it, but there's nothing you can do because it's essentially vague. However, if you make a specific working model, then you can investigate the consequences more in detail. So that's what this is about. So what I've done is made some models of biological structures on a molecular level, on the level of cells and viruses and so forth. In particular, what we have here is a study of a kind of virus called a bacteriophage. It's a kind of virus that infects bacteria. Biologically speaking, this is a very simple structure, so it's relatively easy to understand how it works. It's also been studied extensively for the last, 40 years or so. So by studying this, one can gain some insight into the theory of evolution. The first thing that you're going to see is a protein molecule. That's a three-dimensional model of what a protein looks like. Proteins are the building blocks of organisms on the molecular level. There are a number of other important building blocks also, such as RNA and DNA and so forth. Essentially, a protein is made of many amino acids. These are these different colored groups of balls here. And they have a complex surface structure, as you can see. Now here we see a virus assembling out of component parts inside a bacterium. This, of course, is a model. It's not the real thing. It's more than just art, however. The different parts, these little oval things, represent protein molecules. They're interacting according to laws analogous to those that govern the interaction of real proteins in actual living cells. So they assemble together here to form a complex structure. This is our particular model of a virus. What this virus does is break through the wall of a bacterium. And in a moment here, you'll see how this model actually functions. It'll break through a simulated bacterial wall. It's going to attack this bacterium now. And this section here contracted and drove this central tube through this wall. That is the way the virus breaks into the bacterium. It has a sort of hypodermic syringe that it pokes through the wall of the bacterium, then it injects its DNA through the bacterial wall. So now I'll show you
to many, evolution seems to involve little more than a continuous change in shape and function from one life form to another.
early in the 20th century, D'Arcy Thompson superimposed a coordinate grid on a human skull. He showed that a simple curvilinear transformation would map the human skull to the skull of a chimpanzee. If we apply the inverse of the transformation to an adult chimp's profile, we find it changing into a form similar to a young chimp. This form looks somewhat human, but we are left with the question of how a youthful chimp might be transformed into a human being. One key human feature is the large brain, which might attain human size through the prolongation of infantile growth rates. However, the brains of intelligent people range over a factor of 2 in size, and the real question seems to be, how did the billions of neurons in the brain become organized to manifest unique human abilities? In the 1860s, Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-inventor of Darwin's theory of natural selection, noted that people of primitive societies have abilities as great as those of technologically advanced societies. He suggested that these abilities and the talents of unusual geniuses, such as Mozart, would not be favored by natural selection, and also could not be haphazard byproducts of the natural selection process. This led Wallace to supplement evolutionary mechanisms by divine intervention, a step which greatly shocked his friend Charles Darwin. Darwin declared that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. To illustrate his approach to explaining the origin of complex organs, Darwin proposed that the vertebrate eye began as a nerve connected to a light-sensitive spot. He then proposed a series of plausible intermediate eyes, stressing that extremely slight variations can take one continuously from the light-sensitive spot to the eye of an eagle. These rough sketches may seem superficially plausible, but one might wonder whether well-defined models of the eye could be constructed that would actually show Darwin's series of finely graded intermediates. Such models would have to show how neurons and photosensitive cells gradually became hardwired to perform sophisticated image processing and transmit the resulting data to the brain. The problem here is similar to the problem of brain evolution. We are dealing not with smoothly varying shapes, such as the human skull, but with discrete interacting subunits that fit together in a complex combination. Even the lens of the eye, far from being a simple smooth shape, contains complex layers of cells sutured together by zipper-like interlocking tabs. To gain greater insight into the Darwinian theory of evolution, we propose to study precisely defined mathematical models of the natural selection process. To do this, we first need to define complete working models of the biological systems we wish to study. To help elucidate the effects of mutations and natural selection, these models should demonstrate the operation of the biological system, and they should also demonstrate how the system forms or self-assembles under the direction of genetic coding. Once we have operation and self-assembly in our model, we can define the life cycle of the biological system. Natural selection is simply the change in gene frequencies that automatically occurs as the life cycle takes place and some organisms leave more descendants than others. Under the heading of mutation, we lump together all processes which change genetic coding in a random way. The effect these changes have on biological structures will depend on the self-assembly process. We begin by introducing a simple model for the evolution of the eye lenses of a particular kind of trilobite, an ancient marine organism. Although trilobites have been extinct for millions of years, lenses from their eyes still exist since they were constructed from the mineral calcite. A remarkable feature of these lenses is that they are corrected for the optical defect known as spherical aberration. By dividing the lens into two regions of slightly different refractive index, it is possible to cause light rays emanating from focus F1 to converge accurately to focus F2, thus allowing for a sharp image. This can be achieved if the interface between the two regions follows the ideal curve shown here. This curve was discovered in recent times by Descartes and Huygens, but it is closely approximated in the eyes of ancient trilobites. In our model, we will first assume that the interface curve can undergo a certain kind of random change as a result of genetic mutations. The curve to the right of a randomly chosen point is raised or lowered by a randomly chosen amount. We begin with a straight line as an interface and allow these random changes to occur. If the changes decrease the average divergence of the rays from an exact focus, then they are preserved. Otherwise, they are rejected. With this process of mutation and natural selection, we see that the interface does evolve to the ideal Cartesian curve. Now let us suppose that mutations affect the curve in a different way. Now, randomly placed short segments can be raised or lowered by randomly chosen amounts. Starting again with a straight line and the same selection rule, we find that the evolution process does not converge as quickly to the ideal Cartesian curve. Here we see the result of evolution by this mutation rule after 2,000 cycles of mutation and selection. For comparison, here is the result of the first mutation process after 2,000 cycles. The first type of mutation has its main effect on single segments of the interface curve, and thus it allows different segments to evolve more or less independently of one another. In contrast, the second type affects pairs of segments, and thus interface segments are forced to evolve in an interdependent way. This interdependence tends to slow down evolution, and it can lead to what students of nonlinear optimization call local trapping. As we shall see, trapping due to interdependence can have a profound effect on evolutionary processes. Thus, the self-assembly process, which was not explicitly considered in the model, has an important role to play in theories of evolution. To properly introduce self-assembly into our models, it is necessary to consider the cellular processes of heredity. Unfortunately, this is difficult to do, since the cell, which in Darwin's day seemed to be a simple bag of chemicals, is now known to be formidably complex. For the sake of developing a manageable and yet realistic model, we will therefore consider the evolution of the T4 bacteriophage, an entity that exhibits heredity and reproduction, but is much simpler than a full-fledged cell. The T4 phage consists of an icosahedral head and a tail segment to which is attached a base plate with tail fibers. The phage operates by attaching to the wall of a bacterium with its tail fibers and then fastening the base plate to the bacterial wall. Once the base plate is attached, the tail contracts and drives a central tube into the bacterium. The phage DNA stored in the head then enters the bacterium through this tube. Once inside the bacterium, the phage DNA takes over the bacterial machinery of protein biosynthesis. Phage proteins are generated, and these automatically join together to produce new phages. This process involves the combination of protein subunits in a fixed order along fixed assembly pathways. The subunits making up the T4 phage are protein molecules similar to this one, the enzyme carboxypeptidase. Such a protein consists of a long chain of amino acid molecules that maintains a specific folded configuration under the influence of molecular forces. In these diagrams, the amino acids are color-coded, and the sequence of amino acids in the chain is shown at the bottom of the pictures. Although the surfaces of proteins look random, they typically exhibit specifically patterned binding sites, which enable proteins to interact or join together in a controlled way. Here the sites involved in the joining together of alpha and beta hemoglobin are shown. The specific molecular patterns on these sites allow for the joining of these two molecules and no others. It is important to note that a binding site on a protein molecule may consist of widely separated parts of the underlying amino acid chain. Here this is shown for the active site of carboxypeptidase. It is therefore possible that two sites on a protein, shown here in green and blue, will be interconnected by several parts of the chain. Thus, there is great interdependence among the parts of a protein, and changes in the structure of one part are likely to affect the whole. In making a model of a bacteriophage, we will abstract from real proteins the features needed to represent phage operation and assembly. A three-dimensional model can be made by representing proteins as boxes with numerically coded binding sites on their surfaces. We can also consider two-dimensional models in which proteins are represented by rectangles with similar binding sites. An important feature of these model proteins is the process of conformational change. In this example, subunits A and B join together. A change is then induced in the upper bond site of B, which causes a further change to occur in its lower bond site. This change, in turn, allows B to recognize and join with C, which was previously not possible. Available evidence suggests that the rigidly specified order of assembly in the T4 phage is achieved by means of many conformational change linkages of this kind. Here is a three-dimensional bacteriophage model. Since the self-assembly of the T4 phage head is poorly understood, we have tried here only to simulate the tail and base plate of the T4 phage. The long DNA strand of the real T4 phage is replaced in the model by a short rod which runs from the base to the top of the phage. This DNA rod is surrounded by a coil of subunits which corresponds to the syringe-like tube of the real phage. The coil, in turn, is surrounded by a sheath of subunits which can be triggered to contract and drive the coil through a simulated bacterial cell wall. The self-assembly and operation of the phage are controlled by a network of conformational change linkages. As we can see from these diagrams, this network is quite complex, with each protein subunit interacting in a precisely defined way with several of its neighbors. Here we see several steps in the self-assembly of the phage model, starting with the DNA rod and randomly positioned phage subunits. Subunits collide randomly with the growing phage and are added to it in an orderly way by the action of conformational change linkages. The operation of the phage model is also based on conformational change linkages, which trigger contraction of the sheath once the phage has attached itself to the simulated cell wall. The wall is modeled to simulate an elastic substance that breaks after being stretched beyond a certain limit. Both the phage and the wall satisfy a principle of free energy minimization, similar to that required in real systems by the second law of thermodynamics. What can we say about the evolution of a system such as this model bacteriophage? We can define a life cycle by allowing phages to self-assemble and break a variety of simulated cell walls. Those phages that succeed can be selected for future life cycles, and random mutations can be introduced in the genes specifying phage subunits. What evolutionary transformations will arise from this process of natural selection and mutation? The answer to this question is that the strong interdependence of the phage subunits places severe restrictions on the ability of the phage to evolve. To see why this is so, we will analyze a similar two-dimensional bacteriophage model. This model is also capable of self-assembly, and it operates by attacking a two-dimensional flexible barrier, breaking through it, and placing a small test molecule on the other side. This model is considered to have functioned successfully if the test molecule is transferred to the other side of the barrier and set free to wander randomly. The rectangular subunits of the two-dimensional phage are encoded by strings of symbols, S, B, and K, where S stands for a neutral site, B stands for a bond site, and K stands for a corner. A string is required to fold to form a complete rectangle. A bond site consists of 18 bits and an optional sign, which allow bond sites to recognize and interact only with specific bond sites on other molecules. Any symbol in a bond site string is allowed to mutate with a probability of 10 to the minus 6th power per phage life cycle. Other allowed mutations include insertions and deletions of sites, which also occur with a probability of 10 to the minus 6th power per life cycle. This probability is based on known mutation rates in living cells. Here is a two-dimensional phage design that successfully breaks through a barrier that is 3 units thick. However, it is unable to break through a barrier that is 4 units thick. If we redesign the model by adding an additional subunit and making other related changes, we find that it is able to successfully handle both 3-unit and 4-unit barriers. In an environment containing both 3 and 4-unit barriers, a phage that can penetrate both will have a strong selective advantage over one that fails on 4-unit barriers. In this environment, will the 3-barrier phage on the left be able to evolve to a 4-barrier form, such as the one on the right? Analysis shows that to make the phage more powerful, it is necessary to add a new driving subunit. This can be done by duplicating the gene for one of the old subunits and modifying a minimum of 2 bond sites on the duplicates. This is the minimal change needed to add the new subunit, and this addition is only possible if the bond sites of the duplicated subunits are aligned one above the other. Without this prearranged alignment, additional mutational changes would be needed to add the new subunit. Taking into account the rate of mutations and the need for prearranged alignments, the highest possible probability for adding a new subunit is about 5 times 10 to the minus 19th power. If a new subunit is added, the resulting phage will fail to function unless the 2 side pieces of the phage are simultaneously elongated. This requires adding sites to the side pieces by site insertion mutations. The probabilities for these elongations come to about 10 to the minus 32nd power per side piece, given the assumed mutation rates. The transition from the 3-barrier to the working 4-barrier design requires that all of these mutational changes must occur simultaneously. The probability is therefore less than about 6 times 10 to the minus 84th power, a prohibitively small value. Actually, similar transitions in real complexes of interacting proteins are likely to be far less probable. For example, many simultaneous changes would be required to change the shape of a protein while preserving existing bond sites needed for interaction with other proteins. One might argue that exponential growth rates of microorganisms allow transitions of such low probability to occur. However, the Earth is not large enough for this. For example, the maximum number of E. coli bacteria that could live in a global ocean 8 kilometers deep is less than about 2 × 10⁴ power. In general, models involving many strongly interacting parts tend to require prohibitively improbable simultaneous mutations in order to evolve new functions or improved capacities. One might suggest that this limitation is an artifact of our model and not true of real systems, such as the T4 phage. If this is so, however, it should be possible to formulate phage models which are amenable to evolution, and this should be a topic for further research. Without explicit models of biological systems, the theory of evolution becomes simply an exercise in imaginative storytelling and not a proper scientific theory. We will end by briefly noting some examples of biological machinery to which this model-building approach could be applied. One example is provided by the E. coli bacterium. This bacterium is propelled by spiral flagella that are rotated by motors of molecular dimensions built into the bacterial cell wall. Can one make a working model showing how these motors might have evolved? Another example is provided by the cell walls of bacteria. These walls are made of sheets of cloth-like material. Each sheet is composed of a rectangular array of complex molecular subunits, which are assembled outside the bacterium by the action of special enzymes. Can one make a working model of bacterial wall formation and show through what stages this complex system may have evolved? In the cellular reproduction of DNA, the DNA strands can become entangled. An enzyme called DNA gyrase, envisioned here as a molecular robot, is able to grasp 2 crossing DNA strands. By breaking one strand and reconnecting it on the other side of the other strand, this enzyme can tie or untie knots in DNA. Since this enzyme is essential for cellular reproduction, it would be interesting to make a model of its operation and its origin. Finally, we consider one of the many examples of higher organisms with features that seem to require many simultaneous steps in order to evolve. The statocyst or balance organ of this crustacean depends for its function on a small grain of sand inserted by the animal when it molts. For this arrangement to work, both the complex statocyst and the complex instinctive behavioral pattern seem to be required simultaneously. How did this come about? This lecture was first given in Budapest in 1987 at the International Symposium entitled Organizational Constraints on the Dynamics of Evolution. The models and analysis presented here are discussed in detail in the textbook Computer Simulations of Self-Organization in Biological Systems by N.S. Goel and Richard Thompson.
What I'm doing here is considering the case of something we can analyze on the cellular level, namely this virus. The reason for picking the virus is that it's simple enough to really understand what it's doing, or at least we think we can understand. If you look at and the simplest independent living organism, viruses you see are parasites, they're not independent. But the simplest independent living organism would be, say, a bacterium. The bacterium is so complex that we really don't know how it works, even though the E. coli bacterium, for example, has been studied for many years now by biochemists. Still, there are all kinds of things going on there that nobody understands. So, if you don't understand how a given system works, how can you explain how it originated? First, to explain a series of evolutionary steps leading up to that organism, you would have to, if you were really going to give an explanation, show how each step was viable and how each step would replace the step before it. But if you don't even know how the organism works, how can you know what a viable step is going to be or not? So it's essential to know how the systems work before you can say how they evolve. Otherwise, you don't have a scientific theory of evolution. So that's one point here. So we're taking a virus and asking, could that evolve a slightly more powerful function? We took this example of the thickness of the barrier that it's able to penetrate. So could it evolve from a form that penetrates a barrier of one thickness to a form that's slightly more powerful and can penetrate a thicker barrier? The answer turns out to be that this could not happen because the mutational steps required are too improbable. So in general, what you find is that in structures which have complex interacting parts, evolution is practically prohibited. Now, there are other situations in which evolution is possible, and that was the point of that trilobite eye example. That lens shape could evolve by a Darwinian mechanism. And the reason it could evolve is that it's possible to mutate the lens in such a way that the different changes are independent of one another. The question of independence versus dependence is the important issue here. So if you have a mechanism in which there's great dependence among the different parts, then if you change one part, you automatically have to change other parts in order for the system to still work. And this means that the mutations that are required are very improbable because you have to make one change and another change that matches it perfectly and another change that matches that and so forth. So therefore, you find that evolution is highly improbable. Now, I should make a point concerning these probability calculations for anyone who's ever interested in saying anything in a university about these topics. Typically, Christian creationists will give the following argument regarding probabilities in evolution. They'll say you take a protein molecule like one of those that I was showing here. So you can represent the protein molecule as a stretched out chain of amino acids. So you have a long chain, and along this chain there are successive amino acids. So in a given protein you may have, say, 300 of them. That's a typical number, actually. So they go from 1 to 300. So each amino acid can be one of 20 different types. So you say, okay, here let us put the amino acid indicated by the letter A. That's one of the 20. Here you could put the one indicated by, say, the letter G for glycine. That's one of the 20. So at each point, you have 20 choices. So in total, how many different proteins could you make? Well, 20 choices here times 20 for the second one gives you 400, times 20 for the third one, that's 20 cubed, times 20 for the fourth one. You just keep multiplying 20 all the way out to the end. So there are 20 to the 300th power different proteins you could make. So assuming that you just combine these things together at random with equal probabilities, what is the probability that you'll get this particular protein? Well, it is 1 out of 20 to the 300th power. Now, 20 to the 300th power, well, you can see there are at least 300 zeros in this number. In fact, then there's the 2 to the 300th, so what the heck? It's, you know, if you wrote out that number, you know, you couldn't write it on the blackboard. You'd have to bring in several hundred blackboards in order to completely write the number, basically. So it's a ridiculously small number, or large number, rather. So 1 over that is the probability of hitting one of these proteins. It's ridiculously improbable, so that would never happen. So this is often advanced as an argument against the possibility of forming living organisms by chance, because this is what's involved in forming one particular protein. Well, scientists love to tear this argument apart. They'll say it's completely fallacious. There's so many things they can say about it. For example, they can point out that you don't have to get one precisely defined sequence of amino acids. It's known that in actual proteins, many of the amino acids can vary quite a bit, and the protein still works perfectly well. And many similar objections of this kind are raised. So they tear this argument apart. Not too long ago, I went to a debate between one of the Christian creationists named Duane Gish and a member of the biology department at San Diego State University. So they debated one another. So in this debate, instead of Gish giving this argument, the professor who was opposing him gave this argument, and he just held it up to utter ridicule. And thus Gish didn't even have an opportunity to give it. So the point then is that one has to be a little bit careful about the arguments that one presents. Actually, there are valid arguments involving showing that the evolution of living systems involves steps of exceedingly low probability. However, in order to show this in an adequate way, you need to take something more along the lines of this model-building approach that I was showing here. Basically, the whole point of all this analysis here is to say, all right, if you have a model and you understand how it works, what changes are needed to convert it into a form that will perform some additional function? So you can analyze that and say, well, to do the additional function, I need to add this. And if I add this, then I have to change that, and so forth. And these changes will have such and such probability. So then you try and find a way of making the changes that will give you the largest possible probability. And you can see, for example, in this case, that the largest possible probability is still 10 to the minus 84th power, which means that zero probability of happening, essentially. So that kind of analysis can be presented. So the basic point then is that the process of evolution as understood by the Darwinian theory is not adequate to explain the origin of significant features of living systems. And you can see that definitely in simple examples. In more complex examples, it's very hard to see what's going on because it's difficult to analyze the complex system. People have been, to a certain idea, mesmerized by this idea that things can happen by chance. I once gave a lecture at Johns Hopkins University on this kind of subject matter and pointed out the very low probabilities of some of these evolutionary steps. And the students there seem to be pretty well agreed that, yes, we are simply products of chance. What's wrong with that? But the point to make there is that what one is saying, if one says it's just by chance, is that there's no scientific explanation. A scientific explanation is one that posits a large, reasonably large probability for the indicated event. If you have an explanation which gives an exceedingly small probability and you say, well, it just happened by chance, then what you're in effect saying is that you have no explanation. It seems as though you're explaining it by saying by chance, but this word by chance doesn't really add anything substantial to what you're saying. It's merely a sort of soothing sound that gives the impression that you're explaining something. But an actual scientific explanation has to give a large probability for whatever the phenomenon is that's being explained. So what it amounts to then is that there's no scientific explanation that anybody has for the origin of living systems. And this is a very significant thing because this idea of evolution is the sort of basic foundation stone of the scientific attempt to understand the universe as a whole. If you eliminate that, then what you're left with in science are particular explanations of certain limited phenomena, such as electromagnetism or certain properties of chemical bonds or something like that. But you no longer have a universal explanation that encompasses everything. But that's actually the situation in science. Valid science only gives you certain limited explanations of things. There's no universal picture, actually. Yeah?
Are any scientists, let's say establishment scientists, as you were calling them the other day, posited any kind of a...
Yes, this idea tends to be very unpopular amongst established scientists. There is one interesting example, though. There's a man named Walter Elsasser, who's a very old man now. He's a physicist who became a biologist. And he presented a theory in which you have absolute detailed information existing in nature to specify living systems. But he stated this in such an abstract way that I think nobody criticized it because very few people ever read it or understood it. I finally understood it myself after that lecture I gave at Johns Hopkins. In fact, this Walter Elsasser came to the lecture, and he mailed me a reprint of one of his papers later on. And so I was able to grasp his point at that stage. But he was approaching biology from the point of view of a physicist. Now, physicists posit natural laws. So if you ask a physicist where the natural laws come from, the physicist will answer that we don't explain where the natural laws come from. They're just the starting point for all other explanations. They're, so to speak, the uncaused cause of everything. Janmadyasya yataha. So what Elsasser proposed was that the information defining biological systems has the same status as the laws of physics. Namely, it's uncaused. There's no question of giving an explanation of it. It's just absolute information. Just as we can say that the law of gravity is absolute, we don't say where that comes from, we just start with it. Similarly, the complex information defining living organisms is absolute. This is what Elsasser proposed. But he did it in an extremely abstract way. So no one seems to have objected particularly. So that's interesting because you can use that as a starting point for a line of reasoning which we actually have in the Origins magazine. Namely to say, if you propose that there is absolute information somehow in nature defining living organisms, then what is the nature of that information? Then how does it exist outside of the bodies of the organisms themselves? After all, we see that matter is always in flux. Things are always breaking down. We don't think that anything in this world is permanent. So the information, if it's absolute, could not be embodied in these physical forms, because then how could it be absolute if these forms are so transient? So it must be in some other form then. So what form is it in? So you can consider that question. Then you can consider another line of thought and discuss the whole question of consciousness. One can argue that consciousness is an absolute feature of reality. And we do observe that consciousness tends to be connected with life, at least in our case. So if you then propose that the consciousness, the absolute consciousness, is linked together absolutely with the absolute information defining life, you at least approximate some idea of a sentient being, which is the absolute cause of all the different living organisms. So you can proceed step by step in that way. At least it's a reasonable sequence leading to the idea of an absolute person from whom the different organisms and so forth have become manifest. So you can actually do that if you start with Elsasser's idea and simply add the ingredient of consciousness. So these different lines of reasoning can be presented. Yeah?
This rebuttal to the amino acid scenario, is that, I think that you've published, was it in a non-mechanistic science book or maybe in the Origins magazine, also a scenario about the primordial soup that was so thick and there was such a density.
Yeah.
Right. Is that something which now you would write in a different way?
No, I'm not withdrawing anything. What we presented in the Origin, that was in the Origins magazine. And we presented specifically Fred Hoyle's version of this. This, by the way, is an example of a scientist who came up with one of these ideas and was ridiculed. This Fred Hoyle was a very famous British astronomer and astrophysicist. So somehow or other, he came up with the idea that, well, I guess he approached it by stages, but he finally came up with the idea that there's God, and God is creating life on the Earth. He proposed a somewhat curious method for this. He suggests that outer space is filled with bacteria, which carry genes for successive evolutionary stages. And these are put there by God, starting from some central dissemination point. They drift down through the atmosphere, and when you get sick, being infected by these bacteria, the genes carrying the new evolutionary information get incorporated into your cells, and in this way the evolutionary process takes place. Perhaps he should have been ridiculed for this idea. But anyway, at least he had some idea of an absolute source of the biological information. So anyway, Hoyle made an argument concerning the possibility of having a bacterium evolve. And so he asked for the probability of a single protein to evolve, and he gave a very, conservative probability estimate, allowing the fact that you could have many different substitute amino acids and so forth. And considering the number of proteins you need in a bacterium, he came to a figure of 1 over 10 to the 40,000th power for the probability of this coming together. However, this also was considered with scorn by the scientific community.
Why was it?
Basically, at this point, they practically have a Pavlovian reflex against any probability argument of this kind. Hoyle actually met many of the standard objections because he allowed for the fact that you can have many substitute amino acids in different positions and so on. Of course, they will say that, well, they didn't all come together at once to form a bacterium, but there was a series of stages. This is the basic rebuttal that they would give. The answer to that is that if you say that evolution occurred through a series of stages, you should be prepared to tell us what the stages are. Not that you just say there was a series of stages and we're supposed to believe that, and the question is settled. And what evolutionists do not do is specify the stages that are supposed to have taken place. But that would be their basic answer to Hoyle.
He included the time factor in his calculations. So whether it's done by series or all at once, the time factor he was saying was too short for it to happen. According to the known, the known duration of the
way they would argue it is to say that you have natural selection acting at each stage so as to increase the probability. However, you run into real problems because that means you have to have, at each stage, a self-reproducing organism. And what is the minimum thing that you need for a self-reproducing organism? There is reason to think that a minimum self-reproducing organism will be highly complex. So how do you get that to begin with so that it can then evolve further? This is a real problem.
Or else you have to have some other means by which one form was selected.
Some other means than...
means or non-biological.
Yeah. So basically what is needed to discuss the original origin of life is some model that really shows step by step how it's supposed to happen. And basically the models haven't been proposed yet. You had this...
Yeah, that was just like, I couldn't completely follow. Are you now saying there's no evolution possible? There's no new form which can come out of an old form? Or in other words, like we have this example of bacteria which get resistant to medicines. Is there nothing changing in this bacteria? And how should I understand it?
What I was saying, evolution is possible in some circumstances, and in others it is not possible. And the basic principle behind it is that if the changes involve relatively independent alterations, then the evolution is possible. But if there's a lot of interdependence, then it's not. Just to give an example, a real simple example of evolution in which you have independence. let us suppose that, suppose you talk about moving along a line. Say you start here at zero, and you go to one, and you make small steps, and you have, say, a 3/4 chance of going this way, and a 1/4 chance of going that way. So, if you look at this, you'll see that sooner or later, you're going to reach this point, if this is your rule for movement. Now, suppose you have many such lines, and this is happening independently on each of them. So you start with all your points here. Well, since each one individually is going to go from 0 to 1 in a certain length of time, since all of these are independent, they all will go from 0 to 1 in basically the same length of time, because they're just duplicates of the same thing. So if you think of this as some kind of structure looking like a graph, like this or something, then this graph will definitely evolve from the 0 position to the 1 position. So here's a case where a kind of evolution involving chance and selection. The selection here is shown by having 3/4 instead of 1/4. That's the selective part. And the fact that you're making a random choice, that's the chance aspect. So here you have a case where an evolutionary process will definitely take you from one stage to another. Now that trilobite eye example is similar to this, but not quite that simple. Because there, you're taking the surface of the lens and making changes in its shape. And it turns out, if you look at the model, the changes are more or less independent of one another. Not completely, but nearly so. So it's like this situation. So the lens shape can, in fact, evolve until you get the ideal curve, which focuses the light rays properly. In effect, each light ray has its own little separate lens segment that it goes through. So you're only concerned with that segment for that light ray, and you're concerned with a different one for the next light ray, and so forth. So you have independence. So in cases where there's independence, you can have Darwinian evolution. So that includes, you know, changes in, say, the flu virus, which make us susceptible to new waves of flu. You see, we have antibodies against certain flu viruses. So if a slight change occurs in the structure of the surface of the flu virus, then our antibodies won't react to it anymore. So then we get sick from that virus. So then you have a new flu epidemic, and so forth. All these things are possible. But when you're talking about a structure with many parts that fit together in a coordinated way, then you have problems with the evolution. So that's the basic theme here. Yeah?
You're saying that the creationists, when they use that argument, and they come to that figure 1 to 20, then the scientific theory and the part that even if they rule out a few possibilities, it still remains a huge figure.
Well, they'll try to argue that actually you don't wind up with a huge figure. Their arguments also fail to show that the development of these things should actually be probable. But of course, if you defeat the main force of somebody's argument, that's usually sufficient to weaken that person's position. So that's what they do in attacking the creationists' argument when it's presented in this form. They essentially weaken their position, and then they don't bother to carry it further. So it's good if you're going to put forward an argument, to put forward a strong one that can't be easily discredited. And so, therefore, this particular argument is not so good because it's easy to point out flaws in it. So it's a fact that in dealing with these topics, it can get fairly complicated. But that's the way it is with these things. Of course, one thing you could propose to people is that instead of trying to figure all of these things out, it might be better to adopt the idea of faith in, you know, higher revelation and so forth. But many people are trained to think that that is an outmoded way of approaching things. So the idea is that one can explain some of these problems with the prevailing theory of evolution, and then suggest that, in fact, a reasonable alternative to this is that some kind of intelligent engineering is behind all these myriads of highly complex mechanisms and so forth that we see in nature. And if some kind of higher intelligence is going to the trouble of building all these machines in nature, then perhaps we could also get some more direct communication from that higher intelligence. At least on a theoretical level, that possibility is opened up. Yeah?
Is this higher intelligence eventually also coordinating information, which means that this evolution possible, although the news doesn't say it's possible because the intelligence is behind us?
Well, if you grant this higher intelligence, then it would be possible to have evolution in a coordinated way directed by the higher intelligence. And some people propose a theory like that. So that is, you might say, an intermediate position between the position of the evolutionists and, say, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Now, as it happens, according to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, you don't have a generation-by-generation evolutionary change. Instead, you have a process of transformation going from subtle forms coming down to gross forms. Actually, that is a generation-by-generation process in the sense that you have descent from one family member to another. I gave the other day the example of descent from Vivasvan, the sun god, to Ikshvaku, who's a human being. So Ikshvaku is the grandson of Vivasvan. So you do have transformation in a generation-by-generation fashion. However, it's not like the transformations proposed in the theory of evolution, because there you're gradually improving primitive organisms and making them more complex, and all the organisms are on a gross level from start to finish. But according to the Vedic idea, you're going from higher organizations on a more subtle platform and coming down to grosser levels on a lower level of organization. The basic picture given by the Srimad Bhagavatam for the, say, origin of the human species is as follows. You can start with the manifestation of Brahma within the universe, coming from the lotus flower from the navel of Garbhodakshay Vishnu. The body of Brahma in one verse in the Bhagavatam is described as an incarnation of transcendental sound. It's a rather interesting verse, but there's a whole description, especially in the third canto, of Brahma. So Brahma is imbued with all kinds of information coming from Vishnu, including the seed forms for all the different living species. So Brahma is compared to a gardener. He doesn't create anything in the sense of actually making something new himself, but he just takes seedling forms which are given to him, or actually are part of his body, and he, so to speak, plants them within fertile soil within the universe, and they then proceed to grow in a natural way. And Brahma is concerned with tending the garden, so to speak, and making sure that the conditions for growth are suitable. So Brahma generates different high-level demigods called Prajapatis. These Prajapatis, in turn, produce different demigods. At a certain point, actually at the initial stage, Brahma is doing this by generating forms directly from his mind. So he has different mental sons. But from a certain point onward, the process involves sexual reproduction between the different beings that have been produced at that stage. But in this process of sexual reproduction, instead of one form giving rise to something identical to it, or basically similar, you find that one kind of demigod can give birth to a completely different life form. Also, as a corollary to this, we have the fact that the demigods have a power to assume different forms. So this would suggest, from the point of view of the modern way of thinking, that in the body of one demigod, the information for all kinds of different biological forms is there. Whereas in our body, you only have the information for a human body and nothing else. So they have more information and the power to manifest different shapes and forms This is what you see described in the Vedic literature. So it's described in the Bhagavatam in various places, how different demigods, such as daughters of Daksha, for example, give birth to different species of life, and these then propagate sexually from that point. So the essential process in producing that form lies in the ability of the demigod to transform from one shape or form to another. So that much is described in the Bhagavatam. And one may say this sounds very mythological, but at the same time, at least in a broad sense, because we certainly don't understand the details of how that works, but in a broad sense you can see how if in the subtle form of the demigod, which is basically ethereal, actually Srila Prabhupada said all the different elements are there in the bodies of the demigods, but the concentration of the different elements is different from what you have in, say, the human body. So their bodies are primarily ethereal. So if you propose that in this ethereal body you have information stored there that can define all kinds of different forms, and that within the system that the demigod has for controlling its body, its equivalent of a nervous system or whatever a demigod has, it can call upon that information and manifest these different shapes, then one can get a fairly reasonable picture of how such a thing would be possible. So then all you have to do is propose that the demigod can produce limited shapes that can reproduce from there on in just one particular limited form. Of course, the idea is that ultimately all the information and the power to manipulate that information is coming from Krishna. So he can empower one with different capacities or else restrict the power that one can exhibit. So it's all under Krishna's control. Yeah?
The Vedas stated that there's 8,400,000 species of life.
Yeah.
Does that refer to just on the earth planet or to the whole universe? And what categories would the demigods include?
My understanding is that that refers to the universe, and the 400,000 human forms would include demigods and also many other human-like forms.
For example?
Well, there are all kinds of different beings. There are Gandharvas, Siddhas, Charanas, Yakshas, Rakshasas, Guyakas. You know, there are lists of them mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Interestingly enough, the Bhagavatam refers to ape men. The Kim Purushas are human-like and ape-like. So they're ape men, in effect. And the Sanskrit term Kim Purusha means, is it human? So apparently when you look at one of these, you say, is that human? So therefore they're called Kim Purushas. That's another similar thing. Kinara, it's the same thing. Is it human? Nara also means a human. When we read of 8,400,000 forms in the Vedic literature, it's not obvious what is meant in the Vedic literature by a particular form. For example, take dogs. Is it that dogs in general are one form, or is it that, you know, German shepherds and dachshunds and so on are different forms? We have no idea. It's been suggested from time to time that these forms refer to different states of consciousness. But then where do you draw the line in discussing different states of consciousness? So we really don't know what is meant by the 8,400,000 forms. As far as biological species are concerned, as defined by the scientists adopt the rule that organisms belong to the same species if they can mate and produce fertile offspring. And if they either cannot mate at all or if they produce infertile offspring, they're said to belong to different species. So that's how they define it. This works well with animals, but it doesn't work very well with plants, because you can crossbreed a lot of highly different-looking plants which you'd like to assign to different species. So this is their method of counting. However, it's a fact that scientists have shown difficulty in discriminating among species in this way, because sometimes they'll say there's 100 species of snail in a given place. Then later they'll discover that what they thought were 5 different species of snail are different stages in the growth cycle of one snail. Then they rename them. So there's a good deal of confusion as to the actual number of species. The current estimates are about 2 million plant and animal species, according to the scientific counting. Srila Prabhupada was explaining to us, actually in Washington, D.C., that there are different categories of annihilations, and species get wiped out during these annihilations. Then they're recreated. So human beings have been created, annihilated, and so on many times. So human beings on the earth don't have any one particular origin from the demigods, but this process of production of human forms has occurred many times. So we can read of human beings on the earth during the time of Svayambhuva Manu, because apparently at least at one point, Svayambhuva Manu was reigning in Brahmavarta in India. And at that time, Kardama Muni, the great sage, was meditating on a lake, which Srila Prabhupada said is apparently near the Indus Valley region. So then there's the whole story of how he married Devahuti, who was the daughter of Svayambhuva Manu, and Lord Kapila was born, and so forth. So in more recent times, there's a description of the creation of necessary living beings in the Chakshusha Manvantar by Daksha in his appearance as the son of the Prachetas. What happened was in the Svayambhuva Manvantar, Daksha appeared as the direct son of Brahma, but then he offended Lord Shiva, and his head was replaced with the head of a goat and so forth. And it's explained that he was a bit embarrassed to live in that way, so he shortly died. Later he appeared as the son of the Prachetas in the sixth Manvantar period and created different categories of living beings. Some of his daughters also produced human beings. And another example is given in the, Srila Prabhupada in the purport to the verse in Bhagavad Gita describing how Krishna spoke the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita to the sun god. He points out there that this knowledge was communicated to the sun god 120 million years ago. And the sun god spoke this to his son, Vaivasvata Manu. But in the Treta Yuga of this Yuga cycle, King Ikshvaku was born to Vaivasvata Manu. So you have a period of 120 million years practically on the demigod level, and a couple of million years in this case on the earthly level. But of course, demigod lifespans are so enormous that this is feasible for the demigods. 100 million years for them is just like a few years for us. So that's some information from Bhagavatam and so forth concerning origin of the human species. You see, this evidence we were presenting concerning the fossils and so forth would be consistent with the Vedic view, at least in the sense that it indicates the presence of human beings at various time periods.
Ja, vi siger tak til Sadaputta Das og hans publikum. For teknik og produktion af denne udsendelse stod Yadunandan Das, som også var jeres studievært. Tak for nu, Hare Krishna og på genhør.
Why should a point create a universe? Nowadays, many scientists have managed to talk themselves into believing the Big Bang Theory. And that's actually incredible. They actually believe it. Actually, scientists believe in their theories. They believe in their theories.